And welcome to The Bunker, your need to know on news and politics 5 days a week. I'm Roz Taylor. When you ask people what Keir Starmer stands for, the answer is most likely to be nothing. Don't know. Not sure. Or, slightly more hopefully, people. Yet this is the man who, barring a remarkable reversal in the Tories' fortunes, will be Prime Minister by next winter. Who is he really, and what kind of PM will he be? Tom Baldwin has written a biography of Starmer, and he joins me in the studio. Hello, Tom.
Hello.
What did you discover about Keir Starmer that you didn't know before?
The big answer is that you can't answer it in three words. That's why it's taken a book.
Yep.
He is complicated. And he's complicated like most people are, and politicians aren't usually allowed to be. He's complicated like Britain is. He's complicated like the problems that need to be solved. And he's complicated like the solutions that are needed to solve them. Now, I think that makes him an untypical politician. And I think the media have largely got him wrong. They've given him this sort of two-dimensional definition. They've caricatured him as boring and dull and technocratic. I don't think he's any of those things. And I think people who read the book, and it's not an authorised biography, I talk to the critics too, but I think people who read the book will see a very different Keir Starmer to the one that they think they know.
A number of Labour leaders come from privileged backgrounds. Tony Blair certainly did. Starmer doesn't, though, although quite a lot of people think he does, and they're wrong. How does that make him different? How does his past inform the kind of politician he is?
The short answer to that is I think his childhood formed him in many, many ways. He had a very, very difficult relationship with this rather austere, distant father. He had a mother who was severely disabled. He had three siblings who didn't go to grammar school, didn't go to university, one of whom had pretty severe difficulties learning. So in that space, there wasn't a lot of room to emote or express his feelings, and also a kind of quite a lot of pent-up energy and drive to get out and move on. So I think that has formed a lot of who he is. I also think it explains why he's the first Labour leader for a long time to talk about class and snobbery. Now, this isn't some sort of weird Marxist left-wing thing. Partly it's a story about aspiration and getting on. But he talks about trying to break this class ceiling. I think it's very unusual. It's a very big change from Tony Blair, who basically sort of said the class war is over. Keir Starmer knows it isn't, because his three siblings, who he left behind in this rather well-to-do town, and being working class in a well-to-do town is very tough. Those three siblings tell him every day that there are struggles that in their lives and in other people's lives, paying the bills. And so I think it keeps him in touch with something which a lot of politicians never had.
His sister is a care worker, isn't she?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And she was on a zero-hours contract during COVID. His brother has had a pretty ramshackle life and severe health problems recently. So, you know, they're part of the precariat.
He spent most of his career outside politics, in the law. What kind of barrister was he? As there are many different kinds of barristers.
Well, he was lots of kinds of barristers because he moved through the legal profession. He was an outsider, a human rights lawyer, battling against the state. Then he went on the inside and advised the police in Northern Ireland and became chief prosecutor. I think he was never a kind of jury trial lawyer. He wasn't one to have the jury eating out of the hands with some big arc of rhetoric. He was a judge's lawyer. He was someone who'd win the case on appeal on a minor point of law, fiddly stuff, which doesn't necessarily translate to politics. I mean, there's lots of politicians who have been lawyers. Barack Obama, Tony Blair, Bill Clinton. But they were kind of like the actor lawyers. They were the rhetorical lawyers. They weren't lawyers for very long. Keir Starmer was a lawyer for 30 years. It fixed his identity. And as he says, he never won a case on the basis of who his parents were or where he went to school or what kind of house he lived in. He won cases on the basis of facts and evidence. And so it's quite hard to make that transition, having learnt who you are in a courtroom with your courtroom voice, to then become a retail politician.
And when he became Director of Public Prosecutions, as you say, he'd been a human rights lawyer for quite a long time. It's a big change to move from being an edgy lawyer like that to an establishment job. How did he handle that?
A lot of his colleagues were very critical of it. If you know, there's a sort of cadre of lefty human rights lawyers in the Tory caricature who couldn't understand why this guy who they thought was one of their own was going off to work for the police. And that, I think, is again part of who he is, in that he doesn't have a kind of fixed faction or ideology. He moves with, I think, pretty permanent values into different places where he thinks he can do more. And so he decided, I think probably through his Northern Ireland experience, that he could actually get more done by working on the inside. He began to see how the police weren't necessarily just people you fought in court, but people trying to do a good job. He wanted to work inside the system. And then I think he also changed his mind in some places. Human rights often were seen as instruments for the oppressed or people accused of perpetrating crime. He began to see how human rights could be applied to victims of crime as well. And if you cut into Keir Starmer, I think you'll find some very, very hard-rooted values around human rights, around justice, but also in particular issues like violence against women and girls. He had these very harrowing cases like Fiona Iverson, Jane Clough, which really affected him. And, you know, his eyes will well up when he talks about them. Stephen Lawrence, that was another very big case for him. You know, when he talks about terrorism, he's thinking about people are getting on the plane as well as people falsely accused of terrorism. When he worked in the CPS applying the rule of law and British ideas of justice around the world, he saw that as an opportunity not just to apply human rights, but also to make Britain safer. Because if you get terrorists prosecuted in a safe prosecution in other countries, they're less likely to come here. So a lot of the kind of things which don't fit easily with the left now about who he is are actually about applying the same principles of justice to other areas of law and coming to different conclusions.
Because one of the ways in which his ideas don't fit with the left at the moment is that his critics say he stood for the leadership on a soft left platform that he's largely abandoned. And they say that's a betrayal. Because this is a man who hates his integrity being questioned. You make that absolutely clear in the book. So is it a real challenge for him to maintain that image of principle while changing his mind really quite fast and quite often?
I think it's one of the areas where the critics have a point. I mean, if I was a left-wing person who voted for Keir Starmer because I thought he, you know, was some sort of continuity Corbyn, I'd probably be pissed off. That said, I don't think it's true, and he would certainly say it's not true, that he's abandoned the 10 pledges altogether. If you look at what Labour are promising in the next election, there's actually quite a lot of those 10 pledges still there. I think people tend to see sort of glass half empty rather than glass half full. And sometimes I think he may actually be a radical in plain sight because we've got so used to describing what he's not doing. People actually don't notice just how radical Labour's policy platform still is. The other thing, which I think is fair to point out, is in 2020, you're setting out a series of policy positions. And in between that, you've had COVID, you've had Ukraine, you've had Liz Truss. It's quite weird to think. And one of the weird things about politics is you said something 4 years ago, you must stick to that. That's not how life works. Most people, most walks of life, change their mind when the facts change. In politics, it seems you're not allowed to do that. That's one of the very many things he finds uncomfortable about politics.
You often return to football as a way of explaining his personality. How does that work? He plays it quite a bit. He follows Arsenal with massive devotion. How does football help to explain the kind of man he is?
I think I've described it at one point as footballism. you know, lots of politicians pretend that they like football to make themselves look more normal. One of Keir Starmer's friends, Mark Adams, says Keir probably needs to tone it down if he needs to appear normal because he's quite obsessive about it. And it informs him in lots of ways. At school, and I think in life since, he's used it to normalise himself. So his dad, rather weird dad, wouldn't let him have a TV for a long time. He'd get to school, they'd be talking about Starsky and Hutch. He couldn't join the conversation. Let's play football. Since then, I think he uses that still as a sort of anchor to pull him back to normal, normalcy. It's how he breaks the ice with lots of people. But much more than that, I think it's an expression of who he is. So he's quite a buttoned up person. He talks lyrically about that moment where everyone loses themselves, the last minute winner, and everyone stands up and he says, like a magnet in the sky, pulling everyone up together. That's where he finds a sort of collective sense, which someone like him, I think, probably struggles to find normally. He also sees quite a lot of the rules of life in football. I mean, you know, it's his chosen metaphor, you know, leave it all on the pitch, you know, you're hard but fair, play hard, work hard. You know, he talks about going into government, doing his talking on the pitch, which is another football cliche. At one point, he even compared Mikel Arteta's decision to get rid of Aubameyang, who was their star striker when Arteta took over, to how people took him seriously about anti-Semitism when he got rid of Rebecca Long-Bailey from the Shadow Cabinet. I mean, this is, you know, this is stretching football quite a long way, but it does inform him. And there's another element too, in that there's also a bit of a kind of communitarian streak in him. He likes place. He, more than any Labour leader, he, whenever he goes somewhere, he wants to visit the local football club. He's always telling his staff he wants to go and see Accrington Stanley, because he actually understands the role that football clubs play in communities. They're not just businesses. They're parts of people's identity, as Arsenal is for him.
That makes him quite a British bloke, doesn't it? Someone who expresses himself through football, but otherwise is quite emotionally buttoned up.
I think he's very British, and he's not very ideological, and that's quite British in itself. And in politics, everyone wants to place you on a sort of ideological spectrum, where you're Blairite or Brownite or Miliband-ite, and he doesn't like that. And he has values, and I think most people wouldn't codify their values. I think he believes in things like justice. I think he believes in the rule of law. I think he believes in fairness and decency. But that's not an ideology. It's how you react to things. So it's almost like kind of common law, or the way rivers flow through hills or roads wind. They bend into the folds of national life rather than try and impose themselves. And as such, I think that's quite appealing.
And you say he's quite buttoned up, and you're right. Certainly on TV, he is really stiff, isn't he? And that's very unusual in the modern era, to be quite that uncomfortable in front of a TV camera.
It's unusual for a politician. Hmm. It's not unusual for an ordinary person.
No, true.
I mean, I'm probably more buttoned up because you put a microphone in front of me. He hasn't spent his life in front of a camera. Hmm. He's done courtrooms, and that's a different environment.
Yeah.
I find him, and I think most of his friends would say, quite a warm and funny person. He goes to the pub and he blends in the background better than most people I know, certainly most politicians. Put the camera on him and he goes to a different place. That's a problem for a politician, but I think it also speaks to his normalcy. And I think it's probably also fair to say, and we kind of forget this in the media, because we get a caricature set and we don't ever sort of challenge our own assumptions. He's got a lot better. Because one thing that's really true about him is if he sees a deficiency in his performance, he's very competitive. That's the other bit he gets from football. He's very competitive, and he works and he strives and he's determined to improve. And he doesn't necessarily become the best speaker, but he's a better speaker than he was. He's not the best performer in PMQs, but he's pretty good. So he learns and he strives and he perseveres.
The speech at the party conference last year, when someone scattered glitter over him, that was an improvement, wasn't it? He was definitely more comfortable then. And it was almost as if that incident, which I think he visibly didn't, to me, he visibly was quite angry about, but he managed to tamp that down and move beyond it, didn't he?
There's something we talk about in politics as actions often speak louder than words. It's a cliche in life as well, but there's whole shelf loads of books about, you know, unspoken communication. And in that situation, he could have flinched. A lot of people would have done. Could have turned around and hit him, like John Prescott did. And he didn't. He stood his ground. I thought that was, I mean, if, you know, Labour Party wasn't leading the news that week for another reason. But I thought it was a very, very powerful image. But there's something else about that speech, which I found out later, which is very true of Starmer. So he has this ability to separate himself off from a moment and almost observe it. So this is the biggest speech he's ever made in his life. And some of the glitter had got into these two glasses of water either side of his microphone. And you see him. in pauses for applause, not milking the applause, but looking from one glass to the other. Which one's got the least glitter? What are the consequences of drinking something with glitter? What's the consequence of letting my mouth get too dry? And after 26 minutes of calculation, he takes a drink. And that is very Starmerish. He thinks things through. Sometimes he takes a bit of time over a decision. That's not the same as indecision. But that degree of separation for a moment, I mean, this is very unpolitical. Most politicians would be feeding off the crowd, feeding off the applause. He's thinking about the two glasses of water.
What's he going to struggle with most in power? He lives quite near the studio where we're talking in Kentish Town, and he seems to have quite an attachment to that. And I, in some ways, I found it quite hard to imagine him moving into number 10, although, of course, he'll have to, I suppose. What do you think he will find hardest about that kind of step change when you become PM?
The obvious answer, the hardest thing, is the inheritance he's going to get and the challenges facing this country, which are pretty scary.
Yeah.
But there's also something about him in that he needs these bridges back to his real life to reaffirm who he is. He needs to have his outside football games and see his old friends. He needs to go to watch football. He needs to see his family. He likes being in Kentish Town with, you know, Mehmet, who he buys his groceries off, or Chris, who cuts his hair. And he also doesn't like that to be contaminated too much by politics. He doesn't like to bring that into a story. Because once you start talking about your kids or talking about your friends, they become part of your political brand, and that almost weakens their power for you. So he stubbornly resists this sort of personalization of himself. I mean, I've had to chisel a lot of it out of him for the book. But he didn't want to talk about all this. And so he doesn't want his real life to become a part of his brand. There's also a question about how much of his real life he'll be able to continue to have. You know, he won't be able to sit in a stand at Arsenal. He probably won't be able to play football on Kentish Town's rather worn AstroTurf. His kids will be affected by being in Down Street. They're teenagers, and that's the thing he worries about massively. You know, his wife Vic insists she's going to get the bus to work. I'm not sure whether that's true. So that kind of connection. I mean, one of the last times I interviewed him for the book, he arrived outside his house in this huge cavalcade of security cars and police cars, then goes into his house where the boiler's broken and he's trying to get the plumber in to fix it, and the house is cold and there's a cat fight outside and gets scratched and he's bleeding, dripping blood, and, you know, and he almost, you get a sense he relishes still that bit of normalcy, and he kind of knows it's going, or maybe going, if he wins the next election. He certainly wouldn't claim it's won. At one point I said to him, you know, Boris Johnson did all these expensive refurbishments of the Downing Street flat. Yeah, maybe you could build a replica of the Pineapple Pub inside and install your friends there and pretend you're still in the pub. And his eyes light up for a minute. He goes, no, I can't do that because, you know, that'd be a scandal. Yeah, but is that, how can he still be Keir Starmer and be Prime Minister, is a big question for him.
He'd be happier in a Scandinavian political setting, wouldn't he, whether that kind of thing is still just about possible? He's no Emmanuel Macron. You know, he doesn't seem to thrive on the trappings of power in that way at all.
I genuinely don't think it's why he's in it. He's not, you know, he wants to do something rather than be somebody, and maybe that's what politicians say. I think it's probably truer of him than most. British politics is a pretty awful place. It's shallow. It's shouty. It polarizes. It divides. It's cheap. It's full of hate. None of that, I think, applies to him. And he's had to kind of brace himself to do it because he thinks it's important. But he's not naturally suited to this environment. He doesn't relish it. He doesn't like it. He's doing it for a reason. It's duty, not joy.
And he's in a hurry, isn't he? Because he's 61 now.
He is, and he's deeply frustrated. He thinks he's achieved nothing. I mean, most people might say the speed with which he's transformed the Labour Party is an achievement. He doesn't think that's an achievement, because he thought, you know, when he was first standing to be an MP, he was going to go into Ed Miliband's government as Attorney General or something. And he's spent 9 years in opposition, and he says it's the most unproductive period of his entire life. So he is impatient to get on and do stuff. His, you know, when talk to his advisors, he doesn't like leaning back and having some sort of geopolitical discussion like Tony Blair would do, you know. His eyes light up when you talk about how you can unblock the electricity grid and get sort of more cables from floating wind farms and you know, that's what gets him going. And it's quite boring to lots of journalists. I don't think most journalists know what a floating wind farm looks like. They don't know much about the electricity grid. But that's what the next Labour government will be about. And it will probably make more of a difference to people's lives than any pretty speeches, sound bites, or little social media clips.
What's going to surprise us most about him when he's in power, do you think? Because to most people, he is still an enigma. What will take them aback about the way he behaves and the kind of PM he is?
He's hard. Not hard-hearted, but he's a hard bastard. He is extraordinarily decent to his friends and his family and people he knows. But he has that in a completely separate compartment in his brain to what he has to do in politics. And what he says is, I'd be indecent to the British people if I put my friendships in Parliament ahead of getting a Labour government. But the speed and ruthlessness with which he moves is breathtaking sometimes. It's taken me aback sometimes. And I think it's extraordinary that he's been able to do all that while still be seen as reassuring and a bit dull, a bit plodding. You think of what he's done in the Labour Party the last 3 or 4 years. He's chucked out the person who came second to him in the leadership contest out of the shadow cabinet. He's chucked the person who preceded him as Labour leader out of the party. He's embarked on a series of party reforms which nobody thought he could get through. They thought he's mad to do it. He got them through. He then faced down a Labour Party conference in 2021 where there were organised clumps of about 200 hecklers trying to shout his speech, drown his speech out. And at the end of that speech, Quentin Letts in the Times, the Daily Mail, wherever he was writing at the time, said, oh, he's so boring and plodding. And yeah. I mean, it's a peculiar talent to take the party on a white-knuckle ride and still be seen as dull.
There you go. Keir Starmer, hard bastard. Keir Starmer, the biography, is published by HarperCollins. Thanks so much for joining us, Tom.
Thank you for having me.
And you can support The Bunker in a small way. It's as little as £3 a month by going to Patreon Bunker Podcast. That's what keeps us going, so we're really grateful for your support. I'm Roz Taylor. Thanks for listening. Hello, I'm Roz Taylor with news of Oh God, What Now?, the politics podcast that's never going to leave its voter ID at home. On Friday's show, it's 6 months until the US election and Donald Trump is stuck sitting on trial in a New York courthouse. Is he bulletproof or can Joe Biden turn around the polls? In the second half, it's local elections week, but we've steadily taken power away from local authorities. What if we gave it back? And in the extra bit for supporters, is there a right level of ruthlessness in politics? That's Oh God, What Now? With me, Roz Taylor, Raphael Baer, Hannah Fearn, guest Nikki McCann Ramirez, out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
The Bunker was written and presented by Roz Taylor. The producer was Chris Jones, and the audio producer was me, Jade Bailey. The managing editor is Jacob Jarvis, and the group editor is Andrew Harrison. With music by Kenny Dickinson and artwork by Jim Parrott, The Bunker is a Podmasters production.